Committee, House Resources will come to order. Please note the date, and we do have a quorum with us. We have with us today Representative Hines, Representative Wolf, Vice Chair Massey, myself, and Chairman Tate. And with that, we have online with us the Commissioner of DNR, Tom Irwin. Are you there?
Mr. Chairman, this is Tom Irwin, Commissioner of DNR.
Tom, most of us here, and I'm going to check to make sure that we all have, I've heard you at least twice, some of us three times, and I'm certain that I don't think anybody that hasn't heard you give this presentation, your presentation, of your expectations as Commissioner of DNR, what you expect for the future, how you operate, and we've heard this. And incidentally, the time that we started was 6 minutes after five for the record, after one for the record. So, Tom, I'm going to have the committee ask you any questions to shorten the length of time and so that you don't have to once again go over what you've told us so many times before. And so in the interest of time and efficiency and your time in particular, and I have to apologize once again for you waiting for about an hour and a half, I think, while we were in session the other day, I think Wednesday. So with that, I'm just going to ask members of our committee if they would like to ask you any questions or if you would like to make any further comments.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just start out by saying thank you for the courtesy of letting me do this on a conference call on the phone. And with that, I respect all of us managing our time. Thank you.
Very good. Representative Hines.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom, we just all echo what Chairman Fate said, that we felt very bad the other day having you wait for an hour and a half. So we apologize.
Representative Hines, through the chair, thank you very much. No need to apologize. We understand busy.
No, thank you, Tom. You're very kind. Starting out great, incidentally, with that kind of comment. Yes, Representative Massey.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairman. Commissioner Irwin, I just had a question to ask you. I was meaning to touch base with you on our last meeting, but I didn't get around to doing it. But I don't know if you heard about the issue that's been happening last year up between Anchorage and the Matanuska Valley there at the Kinnick Flats, where BLM owns a parcel of land there, which they closed down to access for residents of the Anchorage and the Matsu area, where people go in to do their hunting or target shooting. And the issue was dealing with the amount of lead that has been found from all of the gunshot, the cartilages of the guns that have been shot, and that area has been shut down. And I did some research on it, and I'm told that that portion of land belongs to BLM, but there could be a land swap that could be done to where BLM could turn that to the state of Alaska under DNR. And I was wondering if you could look into it and get back with your thoughts on that as far as BLM turning the land over to DNR, to where we at the state level could monitor it and keep it up to compliance with the environment, and yet keep it open to access for people that have utilized it. And I suppose the issue came up last year when the airboats from Wasilla, they were taking their airboats out there for demonstrations, and the access was shut off. So I'd like to get a follow-up from you maybe later on, if you could have a chance to look into that.
Vice Chair Massey, through the chair, I only know a limited a bit about it because I've just had help, but I will be very glad to look into it. From limited understanding, I understand that BLM is trying to clean it up for transfer. I think it would just come back to my basic philosophy that I believe the state wants to get all the land it's due, land transferred to it, and want to take care of if there's illegal shooting there and you have lead issues. Those can be taken care of. So just straightforward, yes, I would welcome your input and information on it, and we will get back to you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Commissioner.
Thank you very much. Are there any other questions of Commissioner? Yes, Representative Duttenberg.
Commissioner, in many ways, you are, or your department deals with the face of Alaska, from oil or gas lines or resource development to our state parks. And I wish you the best in managing that. In a lot of ways, you are what people, when they look at Alaska, it's the result of the success of your department, managing the parks and the many waysides and jobs and economic opportunities. So with that, I will thank you.
Thank you very much. Yeah, thank you, Representative Guttenberg. Any other questions or comments from members of the committee? Well, if not, we thank you once again, Commissioner Irwin. You've been before this committee and other committees up here numerous times, and it's always nice to say hello to you personally, but we understand that you can't. And so with that, we'll conclude the oversight on the Commissioner for DNR. We will now take up House Bill 16, which is known as the Amendments to the Stranded Gas Act. And we'll be looking at version
33% net worth of the project, and we all know how huge these projects are, to 15%. That does not lower the bar so much that everybody's going to have a 1% interest and take away the profit advantage of people who really do want to get into this project with large amounts of dollars. But at the same token, it does allow other people, and is an encouragement, as a matter of fact, for other people to do exploration on that, wherever they want to do exploration. But it allows them, certainly, to get into the ball game, because if they are going to be participants in this gas pipeline with stranded gas, they will be able to get into it at a less amount of net worth. The fourth thing it does is changes the date to March 31st, 2005. This will be an amendment that will be offered today in the Oil and Gas Committee. That language was June 30, 2004, which extended the date from the old stranded gas, extended that date. After consideration in the Oil and Gas Committee, it was found that that's just plain too soon. You know, at the end of this session, we're into next session, we're going to be into June 30, 2004. So it's what we did was made it March. We extended it basically 6 months after that, which was reasonable. And we've discussed this with administration. They're agreeable to it. So we have extended that date, which really makes a little bit more sense, to March 31st, 2005, which is still within the structure of the session, so that still some action may be taken. That was the submittal of applications date. The fifth change in the original was it dealt with only one contractor. The language is contractor. We have made it contractors to the plural. Usually, there is more than one contractor being negotiated with, and we wanted to make that clear. The sixth change was a change relating to the wording relative to a $1.5 million expense that has to be rebated to the state with expenses that are incurred by the contractors as they go about the work and the business that they have to do. And we've added some word in there, and we had quite a time with this. I think we spent about an hour on these two words, and we made a lot of fun with them. We had reasonable and redundant, and non-redundant, redundant, and reasonable, reasonable, non-redundant, redundant. And we finally came up with just reasonable, non-redundant, period. Yeah, we in the original language, it had a comma. Today, there will also be an amendment that will be included with the date that we've already described as an amendment to just strike the comma between reasonable and non-redundant. And there's some merit to that. That was put in there so that the expenses incurred by the contractors are reliable expenses. When they submit a bill to the state, or vice versa, in a way, when the state gets reimbursed for the expenses they pay, there's no question as to what the expenses are. Number one, whether they're reasonable expenses and whether they are duplicative, which is what we want to stay away from. So the words non-redundant were put in there. And with that, those are the major changes, and most of you are probably already familiar with the bill itself, which I think, and we have former Senator Parnell here, but I think that was probably forged in about 1997 or thereabouts, somewhere in there. So this is just an amendment, basically, to the Stranded Gas Act with these new amendments that we will be entertaining today, which are to remove a comma and to add the date. So with that, are there any questions?
Do we have a definition for stranded gas? And he says, is that defined?
That was asked. Thank you, Representative Guttenberg. That was asked in oil and gas. There's only really one place where there's stranded gas. All the other places, the Cook Inlet, it's not stranded. It's they're utilizing that gas. The minute they get gas, they use it. There's no other place in the state of Alaska that I know of that has stranded gas other than North Slope. We're talking about North Slope gas in this instance when we talk about stranded gas.
I mean, Madam Chair, it's a term I know when they're doing the reinjection, does that have to do with it? They're leaving it behind? Is that kind of where this time? kind of get a frame of reference.
A strand that really refers to it, it's going to market. Reinjection, it does not go to market. Any other questions?
And there is no other questions.
Okay.
I guess, Mr.
Chairman,
I will just turn it back and then
right.
You can do your...
Thank you, Vice Chair. This is Chairman Fate again, and we do have online. I might make comment here that I think the director of the Division of Oil and Gas, Mark Myers, would be... Commissioner, I don't know whether he's online, but to take his place is Ron Kombelik, but to answer questions. In the meantime, we have other people to testify, and I'm going to get these people who are some are off net and some are on net. I'll take the people who are on net first. And we have Wendy King from ConocoPhillips. Wendy, are you there with us?
Yes, I am, Chairman Fate.
Go right ahead. We're all ears.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Wendy King. I work in gas strategies with ConocoPhillips and the Alaska North Slope Gas Development Team. I'm here today to testify on behalf of ConocoPhillips. ConocoPhillips supports passage of House Bill 16, reauthorizing the Stranded Gas Development Act. ConocoPhillips has a three-pronged strategy to make a gas pipeline through Alaska and Canada a reality. First, federal legislation to streamline the permitting process. Second, federal fiscal legislation, which provides insurance against the risk of extreme price volatility. And third, state legislation reauthorizing the Stranded Gas Development Act. The Stranded Gas Development Act is currently in statute, and it provides a framework for negotiations and reaching an agreement between the state and other parties like ConocoPhillips over a number of issues. House Bill 16 is needed to modify the Stranded Gas Development Act. The existing statute, as currently written, applies only to an LNG project and not to a gas pipeline. In addition, the Stranded Gas Development Act has a date of June 30, 2001, by which companies had to file an application. If it were not for these two limitations, companies that want to build a gas pipeline could be negotiating with the state today under the act and be further down the road towards creating jobs and revenues through building a gas pipeline. In conclusion, we support passage of House Bill 16 in as clean a form as possible. That means making the Stranded Gas Act applicable to a gas pipeline and extending or repealing the date of the act. The committee substitute for House Bill 16 addresses these two requirements, and we urge the committee to pass the bill. Thank you, and I would be happy to try and answer any additional any questions you may have.
Well, thank you very much, Wendy. Do we have any questions of Wendy King from ConocoPhillips? If not, then and thank you very much, Wendy. We'll go to Roger Marks. And Roger, are you there? You're with the Department of Revenue.
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, it would probably make more sense if our division director, Dan Dickinson, made his presentation first, and then I could follow that.
Well, that's fine. If you would like to do that there, why, that's certainly all right with us. So if you will, Dan, go right ahead and lead out.
Thank you very much, Chairman Fate and Chenault, members of the committee. My name is Dan Dickinson, and I'm the Tax Division Director at the Department of Revenue. With me, as you know, is Roger Marks, a petroleum economist, also with the Tax Division. He will speak briefly about the history, intent, and mechanics of the Stranded Gas Act. But first, I think it's very important to introduce ourselves, as the Department of Revenue has many responsibilities under the Stranded Gas Act, and the Tax Division has considerable expertise and experience in oil and gas matters. 5 years ago, we were three different divisions, the Oil and Gas Audit Division, the Income and Excise Audit Division, and the Charitable Gaming Division. And I'm convinced we probably made a huge mistake after all these mergers by naming ourselves the Tax Division, because nobody wants to be seen with us anymore in public. Anyway, what we do can be seen from the fiscal year 2002 Comprehensive Annual Financial Report for the State of Alaska. And you have an excerpt of Table 113 there with my testimony. Of total government fund revenues of $3.5 billion, the largest piece, we all know, $1.3 billion, comes from the Fed. Taxes are another $1 billion. Royalties are another $900 million. Interest, investment income, plus all the other ways the government raises money through charges for services, fines and forfeitures, and other, is more than offset by the investment losses in the state accounts. The tax division administers 19 of the 20 tax types that make up the $1 billion tax figure. And of the $1 billion in taxes, all but a couple hundred million are oil and gas taxes. Now, the state's oil and gas take is often characterized as four bites of the apple, and we are experienced in all four bites. For the first bites, we are charged under statute with auditing royalties, net profit share leases, and we work closely with DNR on those matters. The other three bites of the apple cover the three areas that we anticipate will be our focus in any Stranded Gas Act negotiation. The second bite of that apple is the oil and gas property tax. The 2003 tax roll showing oil and gas property valued at just about $13.5 billion is being mailed out this afternoon, even as we speak, to meet our March 1st deadline. As petroleum economist Roger Marks will explain later, property taxes play a unique role in determining any natural gas project's profitability. The next bite of the apple is the oil and gas corporate income tax. Income taxes are focused on taxing profits. And as Roger will elaborate later on, the more we focus on taxing profits, the more progressive our system becomes. That is one of the stated goals of the Stranded Gas Act. We have a large, experienced group in our division that works on these issues, and we expect them to be critical. The last bite of the apple is the production tax. Like royalty, production tax focuses on the commodity value of the resource at or near the wellhead. We have lots of experience in this area, dealing with market pricing, intercompany transfer pricing, how markets work, how energy contracts work, business practices, cost analysis. I would like to add a personal observation, but one that I think reflects what many of us in the division believe the state should be trying to achieve in a Stranded Gas Act negotiation. Taxes, and the government take in general that is the subject of the Stranded Gas Act, should not distort commercial realities. The government's take should not be what is red-lighting this project. As Roger will explain, our current fiscal system intensifies some of the risks faced by the producers. Ironically, not only the producers, but the state could be better off changing these aspects of its fiscal system. The Stranded Gas Act negotiations should be about risk sharing and who among the state and the commercial entities involved can best handle what risk. As soon as House Bill 16 becomes law, we can start discussing how price risk will be shared, or how return on investment in the pipeline will be taxed, or really figure out what each party wants to get from this project, aside from more. There are lots of specifics that can be set aside until it's clear how our gas will fit in the market mechanisms that will be in place when we finally are ready to market. But fundamentally, the state's role should not be to increase the risk, and maybe we can make this project fly by reducing risk. On the other hand, we have to make sure that the state is not naively underwriting a risky project. The only ones who will still be around if things go sour, we don't want to be left holding a bag that we didn't quite understand the dimensions of. And that's my quick overview of the Department of Revenue Tax Division. The administration strongly supports the committee substitute for this bill. We think it creates a great mechanism to work these difficult issues we face. The tax division looks forward to being able to play our part in that work. Thank you, and I have any questions, and if they're easy ones, I'll take, and if they're hard ones, I'll wait till Roger talks.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dickinson, and we'll see if we have any questions here from our committee. Yes, Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dickinson, great testimony, and I appreciate, I'm sure we all do, a written version of it. When you're talking about the risk sharing and the role that the state should play and the difference between standing in the way and getting what's best out of the state, how do we balance that? How do we know what that is?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, I don't need to be cute, but very carefully and very thoughtfully. I think clearly the state has to figure out what it wants. What kind of a stream of revenue it wants? How much progressivity does it want to be built in? and how much risk it's willing to undertake. And those are difficult conversations, but the state needs to know where it stands before it deals with the other parties on those issues. And I guess the best answer is by thoroughly airing the issues and thoroughly investigating them.
Can I follow up?
Yes, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is HB 66 get us to a good point where the next phase is us understanding that if a project comes forward? Does this get the state out of the way by having, by opening the definition of stranded gas, extending the expiration date out? Does this get us, does this move us from being this obviously does move us from being an obstacle out, but is there anything else that we should be doing that would clear a path that the state structurally is in the way of?
Representative Bloomberg, through the chair. No, I think what this bill does is it starts the conversation. This bill doesn't either get us out of the way or put us more firmly in the way. It simply creates a structure where we can have a conversation, the parties know what that conversation can lead to, and you can figure out what's important to each party and try to work on it. I think it's best to simply, pass the bill, the amendments as have been suggested, because that starts the conversation. I think that's the most important first step.
Very good. Well, thank you. Any other questions of Mr. Dickinson? If not, thank you very much for your testimony. I just have a slight question, and you just touched on it. You said as soon as passage that we can start discussing this. Do you perceive or do you believe that after the passage of this, hopefully through this body and through the other, the negotiations might even begin to take place to explore at least those areas that you mentioned?
Mr. Chairman, I would hope so. I mean, I believe that you have to start, first of all, if you will, negotiating the larger contract, the mutual understandings. What are you trying to accomplish here? What are the parties think this can accomplish? And I think those conversations can start very soon, and you don't need to do, this isn't about crossing T's and dotting I's. It's about making sure that both parties have a common understanding of what they can accomplish.
Very good. Thank you very much. Any other questions? And with that, we'll go to Roger Marks.
Thank you for your time.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Roger Marks. I am a petroleum economist with the Tax Division of the Department of Revenue. I worked on the original Stranded Gas Act in 1998, and I'm familiar with its history and patent mechanics. And I would like to provide a very brief overview of the act at AS 4382. A more detailed synopsis is with the fiscal note. The act originated in HB 250 in 1997, which established a North Slope Gas commercialization team in the administration to research and recommend changes to state law to encourage commercialization of North Slope Gas. The team concluded that the project faced considerable risk, namely gas price risk and cost overrun risk, and that the state's fiscal system exacerbated those risks. Two of the risks of particular concern were fiscal uncertainty and the state's regressive tax system. A brief comment on the price risk. The cost of the project is very large, $20 billion. That is a lot of money to any corporation. If this project is built and prices go very low, the producers face very large losses, which some of them may not be able to tolerate. That is why the price mechanism proposed in Congress may be a very necessary linchpin in making this project a reality. By fiscal uncertainty, we mean the threat of changes in fiscal provisions after a project is built that may change the project's viability after it is too late to do anything about it. A project may be feasible under one tax system. If it is built under the assumption that the tax system in place will stay in place, but the tax system changes, the changes could cause heavy financial losses. Second, there are two significant elements of the state's fiscal system that make it regressive. By regressive, we mean that the state's take is a high percentage of income at low prices and a low percentage at high prices. First, the property tax is based on cost. The higher the cost, the higher the tax. This is a double whammy to any investor who incurs a cost overrun. Moreover, the property tax is payable when construction begins, years before revenues start accruing. On a time value of money basis, this diminishes the rate of return and increases the risk of not recovering the investment. The second regressive elements are the severance tax and royalty. They are based on the value at the point where the gas comes out of the ground and ignore upstream costs such as capital and operating costs. Thus, when costs are high and prices are low, the state's take is a high percentage of low income. Again, this intensifies the danger of low prices. I might add that a regressive system also limits the state's take at high prices. Fixing that could be very important to the state for securing more revenue when prices are high without threatening the viability of the project. The Stranded Gas Act was the result of trying to fix these shortcomings. The law provided a mechanism for converting the state's fiscal system from a statutory basis to a contractual basis. This would provide for greater fiscal certainty. The fiscal system will be negotiated between the state and the project sponsors and approved by the legislature after a public review period. Payments to the state would be made in lieu of taxes, and per the act, the contract terms would provide for a more progressive or less regressive system. Most of the provisions subject to negotiation are the tax provisions. Given that the royalty represents the state's ownership share, there was not interest in making the royalty rate subject to change. The only royalty provision subject to negotiation would be gas valuation method and the timing of royalty in kind and in value notices. The Commissioner of Revenue would be the primary agent for negotiating and implementing the contract. However, the Commissioner of Natural Resources is also responsible for reviewing the project plan for acceptability and for negotiating any changes in those royalty issues. There was concern by local municipalities that a contract could compromise their property tax revenues. Accordingly, the Act created a municipal advisory group to participate in developing contract terms, and the Act requires that a fair and reasonable share of the payments due under the contract be paid to affected municipalities with due regard to the size of the tax base that may be exempted and the economic and social burdens imposed by construction and operation. The Act also has provisions for sponsors to help make gas available to communities, to promote local hire, to deal with confidential information provided by the sponsors, and to reimburse the state for contractors it may use to assist in the negotiation process. Finally, there were some questions raised as to whether this would surrender or contract away the power to tax, which is forbidden by our Constitution. It was the administration's judgment that this would not preclude future legislatures from imposing other taxes, but this contract would represent a solemn pledge, a moral commitment by the state, and a message to future legislatures that once it agrees to the terms, it will not change them. And with that, I'll take any questions if there are any.
Are there any questions from the committee?
Sure.
I don't know if anybody raised their hands. One just did. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a few big questions. What, in your opinion, we hear that basically this project will go, or a gas project will go when the market allows it to. Could you give me just an evaluation of that, how accurate that is, or what's your opinion of that?
But whether this project will happen, I think history is evolving as we speak, and I would reiterate that at a very significant linchpin is what happens in Congress. The price risk here is a very scary thing for companies. At $20 billion, if something goes wrong, it could be financial catastrophes to even companies the size of Exxon, ConocoPhillips, or BP.
I appreciate the answer for Representative Guttenberg. Do you have any other questions or follow-up of Representative Massey?
Are you done, Representative?
I have other questions.
Okay. Do you? We'll then go right ahead.
In your statement, the Commissioner of Revenue will be the primary agent for negotiating and implement. Then you say, however, Commissioner of DNR is also responsible for reviewing the project plan for acceptability. Do you see that as a conflict? You kind of have a qualifier in it.
No, it simply means that both commissioners would review a project application for suitability. I suppose if one commissioner thought an application was suitable and one thought it wasn't, that would create a conflict, but I have confidence they would be able to land on the same page in that judgment.
Thank you, and I might even add to this for the benefit of you, Representative Guttenberg. At one time, we had separated those commissioners in some language that we thought might fit well into a CS. And we deleted that because in conversation with certainly the divisions and the administration, that's an internal matter. They will write a letter of a memorandum of understanding internally between the departments, which is what they should be doing in the first place, not with interference from the legislature. That's an administrative type of an issue. And so we did not continue with the language that we would have put in here. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Massey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to reflect on, you provided us with written testimony, or this was Dan Dixon that had sent this in, but in the very end on it's on page 2, it says, as soon as House Bill 16 becomes law, we can start discussing how price risk would be shared, or how return on the investment in the pipeline will be taxed, or really figure out what each party wants to get from this project aside from more. And I think that's pretty important, Mr. Co-Chairman. I'm just bringing it up as a comment because I see, you know, we need to expedite this bill and start working on getting an LNG project going or a natural gas project going. And I think this bill is pretty much a housekeeping measure, but I wanted you to maybe highlight a little more on that comment, Dan, if you're still online.
Representative Massick, through the chair, I am, and I guess I think what those were just some of the issues that might be addressed, but clearly there's a whole gamut of them, and the earlier we start, the more likely they will be productive. So I appreciate your focusing on that on those issues. I think they're important ones.
Thank you very much, Dan, for your comment there. And Mr. Co-Chairman, I know you did bring up the issue on some issues dealing with the bill and the deadline date. And I think I wanted to highlight a little bit on it, if you were going to offer an amendment to it, and would that be dealing with the application deadline, or?
To answer your question, yes.
Okay.
That just simply changes that from June 30, 2004, and we will be offering that as amendment number one, June 30, 2004 to March 31st, 2005. We're a little premature because after we get through with our public testimony, and I think we have one more at least, then we will have that amendment number one before us. And the fact is, I'll give you the gavel, Vice Chair, while I entertain that motion of the amendment.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And is there any more comment from you, either Roger or Dan? If not, we appreciate your testimony, and hopefully this thing will move along, and you'll be able to begin those expirations of the negotiations. Quicker the better.
Thank you.
We have also with us Ken Conrad, and Ken is off net. And thanks for bearing with us, Ken. Ken is from British Petroleum, and we're delighted to have you with us, Ken.
Oh, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name's Ken Conrad. I'm Vice President of Gas for BP Alaska. Establishing a clear, simple, and predictable framework regarding royalties and taxes is essential. The gas pipeline project is going to advance to the next phase of activity. Without knowing what the rules are in advance, a project of this magnitude will not be able to attract investment. BP has been a supporter of the Stranded Gas Act since its development many years ago, and we continue to be a supporter. and as such, we support House Bill 16. However, we don't think it's we would be prepared to sit down at any time and begin these discussions, and don't necessarily feel that we need to wait too long to begin these discussions, because we are concerned that we can't finish the discussions until we begin them. So we are ready at any time to move forward. And I would echo what Ms. King conveyed earlier, that as the bill passes through the legislative process, that we ensure that it remain a clean bill, and that we don't inadvertently add add amendments that could inadvertently lead to being a disincentive for the project. But as the bill stands now, we are firmly in support. That would conclude my comments. I'd be more than happy to take any questions.
Well, thank you very much, Ken. It's nice to have you on the line again. Are there any questions? With not, are there any comments or questions from the audience? There being none, we will conclude the public testimony. And now we will go to, and I'll turn this over once again to the Vice Chair of the Gavel, so that I can, as a sponsor, make the amendment here.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, are we done with the public testimony?
Yes, we are. And if I could have Jim Pound, have they got all the did you hand all out the Amendment 1?
I did not. I just gave you a copy of it.
That's what we're looking for. Let's take a quick at ease, a brief at ease. Quick.
Resource Committee back to order. Co-chairman, we have in front of us Amendment number 1. Representative Hines?
Yes, I'd like to ask unanimous consent to adopt Amendment number 1.
And members have Amendment number 1, and that would refer to page 3, line 6. It would change the date from June 30th, 2004 to March 31, 2005. Are there any objections? Hearing none, Amendment number 1 is passed. Representative Hines?
There's also another one within.
I'd like to ask for unanimous consent to adopt Amendment number 2.
And members have the amendment in front of them. That would be dealing with page 3, line 12. It would delete the comma between reasonable and non-redundant. Is there any objection to the...
Objection for discussion.
Okay.
What does it do when you take the comma?
I will turn that over to the chair. Mr. Chairman?
Thank you, Representative Gunbur, for asking that question. We spent an hour and a half on this, I think, the other day.
I'm assuming you have one line answer.
There were some that wanted reasonable, period. There were some that wanted non-redundant. And there were some that wanted reasonable, comma, non-redundant, like what? It simply ensures that there won't be a duplication for which billing will take place. In other words, no double billing. And it ensures that that has to be reviewed, whether or not, for there may be times when you may want to reduplicate a study for confirmation of that original study, for example. Well, that is reasonable, and it's in this context, it's really not non-redundant. So this is really the reason for the language in there. I think that the industry understands it, and we certainly do understand it. It's a protective mechanism. We got hung up on the verbiage, but I think the intent is clear, and this is why we're taking that comma out, because you could really, by just having reasonable, which is fine, but and then just non-redundant, you could beat that one to death. But if non-redundancy is reasonable, why, then you're in pretty good shape. So this is why the comment is taken out. And this is the Oil and Gas Committee, as I said, went through this this language. This is why we were amused when you brought this thing up, because we were saying, you know, here we go again. But that's truly the explanation.
Yeah. I remove my objection.
Thank you, Representative Guttenberg, here.
Yeah.
Having that on record now, we have it clarified. So amendment number 2 passes. So we have in front of us the CS for House Bill number 16 as amended by the Resource Committee. And I believe there are no more amendments that is going to be brought before us today. And I will...
I have a question I would like to make to either Mr. Marks or Mr. Dickinson, if they're still online.
Mark Myers, are you still there? Are you there now to ask questions? And Dan Dickinson, are you there?
Mr. Chairman, this is Mark Myers. I'm here.
Yeah, I think Representative Guttenberg has a question that you or either Mr. Dickinson might would like to answer. Go ahead,
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Under contract development 4382-200, there's a list of requirements to develop a contract. And I have a term here in front of me, and I was wondering if I could get some response from you. And the way it reads is, in addition to those 8, 1, 2, 3, 4 letters, it's adding another one saying, terms regarding an equity or other participating interest in a project by one or more Alaskan-based corporations or businesses. So you're putting in a requirement that an Alaskan-based corporation or business guarantees an involvement. What does that do to the negotiation?
Dan, did you want to answer that question?
This is Mr. Marks. Mr. Dickinson has left, but I could answer that question on his behalf.
Okay.
I think the way this process works is a sponsor group comes forward to the state with an application, and I think whoever is going to have an equity interest in the project would be part of the sponsor group that approaches the state for a stranded gas contract. I think it would be not appropriate to bring in further equity participants in the contract development process. That would be very messy. I think what has to happen is whoever's going to be a sponsor should come in at the front end to the state to negotiate as one body. There's certainly nothing precludes multiple sponsor groups from coming in to negotiate contracts if there's more than one possibility on the table. But again, I think that chef at the front end among sponsor groups is putting together their equity partners.
Follow up, Representative Guttenberg.
My concern is that another gas field developer will come in after the fact and not have a place to market or a gas line to take his product to market. What happens in that case? If there's a large independent, a large person outside of the original contractor comes on board and says, I've got gas to market, does he have access to this gas line?
At the time a pipeline is constructed, the sponsors per FERC law will have to have an open season, and anyone who anticipates having gas that they may want to ship to the pipeline at that time can secure capacity. Is our judgment that probably having the original sponsors build for capacity that might not be there in terms of reducing risk for the project is going the wrong way. Build for capacity that might not be used. It just adds an additional cost to the project and creates additional risk. In addition, pipelines can be constructed to have some expansion of capacity as well.
Yeah, thank you, Marsh. I have some other concerns, but dealing with that open season, but I don't think it relates to this bill.
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, this is Mark Myers.
Yeah, go ahead, Mark. This is a Chairman Fee.
Yeah, if I could add a few comments along to maybe answer some of Representative Guttenberg's questions. The contract development part there in 3 and 4 under the Act doesn't address the issue of access, really. It doesn't refer to that. Access issues with access probably could be addressed under the more general provisions, under the other conditions. However, again, those sections that you're referring to don't refer to access. Access is a real concern for all parties involved with the gas line. And I'll just leave it at that. And I guess our reading of this is it could be included as part of the negotiations. It's not restricted, but it's not implicit in the Act that that would, in fact, be negotiated.
Thank you.
Representative Massey.
Just to follow up on that point, Mr. Chairman, I note the representative from Fairbanks is dealing with the fiscal note question. I guess that's a DNR fiscal note. On page 2, it says give us a breakdown, and they're asking for $600,000 for a two-year period. Representative Guttenberg, was that the area that you had concerns with? Okay, that's a separate topic then. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any other questions from those who are online that will take answers? You had one? Okay. And I might add to what Mr. Myers has said, that last year during some debate on a House bill, I think it was 519, and during the course of some discussion with what was then known as the Joint Pipeline Committee, open season, the frequency of open season, and access to any proposed pipeline were two of the most critical questions and issues. The negotiators know that. The industry knows that. It's a mature field in the oil field up there. We need and want, as has been expressed by some of the major producers, a second level mid-cap industry of oil people up there. And so I think, and I'm sure, that we have the opportunity as legislators to still weigh in with legislation should negotiations, and I don't want to really interfere with this because my view of this is that we need to get to 6 or 8 of the best negotiators on the state side that we can get, who know what they're doing, who are professionals at it, and get into a closed room with the industry's negotiators who they are very good at it, and come out of that room with a splendid contract. And I think, hopefully, that's what may happen. I don't have the concern about access and the open season that I did a year ago. So I would hope that that we can pass this particular piece of legislation on to the Finance Committee. Any other questions or comments from our committee? Then, what is your will? Would somebody like to make a motion? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that committee substitute for House Bill 16 as amended, with the tax fiscal notes be moved from committee with individual recommendations.
Okay, is there any objection? So ordered. And I want to thank everybody on this committee, and I want to thank everybody in the audience, and especially I want to thank those people that testified today. You've persevered. It's now 2 o'clock in the afternoon. We actually did a shorter job with this than we did in the Oil and Gas Committee with redundancy. So, saying that, this meeting is adjourned. Please stick around and sign the book. Thank you.